Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen, and I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, Robert Sears, as well as the occasional special guest from the wider investment team to answer the big questions family investors are facing today. For those who don't know us already, CapGen is a private investment office for families with capital. We are go-anywhere investors. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover any question across any asset class in any region of the world, from bricks and mortar to portfolio derivatives. In summary, this is a podcast where we answer the questions playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. Do subscribe if that sounds up your street, and you'll enjoy two episodes a month of Talking Capital. Robert, as we record this, markets are digesting the news of the first interest rate hike by the Bank of Japan for 17 years, finally ending their negative interest rate policy, the last central bank to do so. And I think there were some subsidiary announcements about yield curve control and activity in the ETF market to boot. Just to recap, Japan, the Nikkei peaked on the 29th of December 1989 and unleashed deflationary pressures into the economy that then 19 years later were further reinforced by the global financial crisis. And here we are, almost 35 years after that equity peak and 15 years after the financial crisis, seeing Japanese policymakers trying again to normalize monetary policy. So it is all pretty historic. Robert, you flagged this as a possibility. Can you just, recognizing that it was only announced in the morning, Japanese time this morning, but can you talk a little bit about what led the BOJ to take this pretty much trailered step?
Yeah, I think it was widely anticipated by the market, and what we can come to sort of immediate reaction is actually pretty muted in a sense that quite a lot was baked in. So baked into the price, in other words. So it was widely anticipated that the Bank of Japan would do something. Now, I think maybe the question is, why didn't they do anything sooner? When we see that the Bank of Japan has been an outlier, so it was the first bank that went into the very low interest rate world and sort of quantitative easing as a way to try and engender some inflation into their economy. And in many ways, it is an outlier with its rates so low while the rest of the world has seen interest rates go up. So that's led to this widespread. And one of the reasons why we've seen a very sharp weakness to the Japanese yen, that it's trading at such a very weak level, particularly against the dollar, over the last several months in particular. So there's this pressure on the currency, a pressure on their monetary policy being very divergent to the rest of the world. And now you could give an excuse for that if the economy in Japan still had lots of deflationary pressures, but also combined with that sort of difference in policy, actually Japan has been benefiting from some of the inflationary pressures that there have been in the last several years. And we've seen finally the shooting signs of or early signs of inflation in Japan. Japanese inflation was flirting around the target 2% levels, albeit we've seen disinflationary pressures of late. But the recent wage negotiations in the public sector, the Shunto negotiations, saw decent levels of inflation and wage growth there. So there's been some pressures of sort of wage growth finally maybe starting to see signs of life in Japan. So it's a good news, actually, that they are going to try and exit their policy, first in terms of getting positive rates, secondly in terms of ending some of the emergency purchases, really, of real estate and equity securities. So that's good news. And also not yield curve control. But why has the market so far been a bit, the reaction's been relatively muted? I think it's because maybe it was signaled to be more, this is going to be a slow process, and maybe one step is all you're likely to see without further evidence of inflation in the economy. So I think that's certainly one of the factors is, it doesn't look like this is the start of a series of measures. And rates, even if they're slightly positive, still have a big spread to the rest of the world. So I think that's a really key important point. I think secondly, the domestic policy support is perhaps less strong than it was a few years ago. So Abe was in a really strong domestic political position. The current prime minister's position has a lot less backing. So it's not certain he's going to be around for a sustained period of time, and maybe future policymakers and politicians are going to have a different level of backing for the policy. So I think those are some of the reasons, alongside the fact that actually the inflationary pressures in Japan, they're very early stages, and inflation still and growth is flirting around the 0% level in many ways. So it's not a sustained evidence of inflation being unleashed in Japan. So I think those are some of the reasons why it's less been sort of less a more muted reaction than maybe some would anticipate. Having said that, I think it remains a key market issue and something to watch very closely, because there's still a lot of pressure on the currency. So the currency, even at the moment, it is the pressure to go through that symbolic level of 150 yen to the dollar is important. So I think the currency market is going to be a forcing condition. I think secondly, even though it's the first signal, the signaling is there, and domestic investors are going to start to realign themselves, not want to take unhedged positions. They want to repatriate some of the yen back to Japan, and that could be a significant capital move. So I think those factors in particular are going to mean this is actually significant, and it will be something to watch, and could be a source of volatility for markets. But I just want to make one point. I think because I was reading the very good book by Edward Chancellor on the price of time on interest rates, which I think I'd recommend to anybody. But when we talk about Japan being the experiment in terms of QE, that's not really the case. There's been QE actually tried in America in the 1930s, but even going as far back in time as Emperor Tiberius, there've been these moments, and it doesn't where actually you need to try this moment of injecting liquidity, cutting rates to rock bottom levels to try and support economies. I think the so what, the dangerous element is actually it's the coming out of that period when interest rates do begin to rise again. It's often led to problems, and I think that's why this Japanese measure is really important to look at. Is it may be the canary in the coal mine. It could be a source of volatility. And it is when economies are vulnerable to rates starting to go back up again.
So let's take this little diversion, Robert. So we've talked here about the fact that we do like the Japanese currency, we do like Japanese equities, and you've touched a little bit on what the impact on the currency might be. Has this changed your mind about the Japanese equity trade, or has it reinforced your view, or is it neutral and different?
Well, I think at the core, it's quite a good sign. I think we do want to normalize conditions, and being stuck in that position is not great. And actually, for that trade, I think the elements that support it are Japanese equities still remain cheap, so that's still good. There's still ample scope for the balance sheets to be made more efficient, for return on equity to increase over time with better corporate governance and more shareholder-friendly capital allocation and shareholder-friendly decisions. So all that positive fundamental news is still in place on Japanese equities. Actually, ending extreme monetary policy could be good on the currency side eventually. So that's where you will actually see the benefit of potentially a stronger yen and better conditions for Japan. For a Japanese economy with positive inflation and positive wage growth will be really good and support the domestic economy. So I think the reasons why we're going to see policy normalize actually could be more positive for that equity story, albeit there'll be volatility, and there could be volatility in between as we see some of those capital flows realign.
So we started out going to talk about US interest rates, and then conversation was slightly photobombed by the BOJ announcement. So now that's done, let's go back to the US and US interest rates, which, you know, arguably are more immediately important for markets. Can you talk a little bit, Robert, about what we've learned from recent inflation data that might help us see what's coming next. And I suppose we see things move around on a sort of quarterly basis. We had a bit of a pivot at the tail end of last year where everyone on the back of some comments by Jay Powell became more optimistic about the number of cuts. The fact that rates had probably peaked and the number of cuts there was going to be in 2024. And here we are getting to almost 3 months through 2024. What do we now think about what's going to happen for the remainder of the year and how the market is sort of pricing and thinking about those expectations?
Well, I think we've termed this in the past the reflexive dance between the policymakers and the market in terms of what's happening with interest rates and the expectations of policy moves. And this reflexive dance is pretty key to what we're going to see during the course of the year. So clearly, the Fed pivot, as it was termed in Q3, led to a lot of risk-taking in the rest of the markets as financial conditions eased. So it wasn't just in terms of interest rates, but we've seen that in equity credit markets. A really buoyant risk-taking mood is starting to set foot in for this year. On the back of partly not just policy expectations, but also, so not only was policy expected to be very loose this year and priced in about 7 rate cuts in the US, but also data's continued to be very resilient for the US economy. So the consumer continues to spend, and we haven't seen a real deterioration in the labor market yet at a headline level. So that was sort of where, which in the paradoxical way, actually, the more the market eases conditions, actually, the tighter the Federal Reserve will have to be. And that's what we've seen in the last month or so, really, the market starting to realize on the back of some comments from the Federal Reserve that we're unlikely to see those 7 cuts. And now we're pricing in sort of half that number. And even the possibility of no cuts this year is starting to emerge. So we're seeing that repricing start to be felt. And we're a bit at the mercy of the gods in terms of the timing of when we record this, in the announcement from the Federal Reserve, again, could start to, the dot plots could themselves start to realign with that viewpoint that there'll be fewer cuts this year. So I think it is a process. It's a tug of war between the two sides. When we look at it in sort of reality, I think the market had overdone the cuts. So pricing in 7 rate cuts really needed a big deterioration in economic data. And at the moment, the economic data, as we say, remains good. And markets are pricing in that good news in terms of earnings for this year. So I think it is only natural that we see the pricing of fewer cuts for this year start to reassert itself.
And the point I think you're making there, Robert, is, or let me pose a question which I think you've answered. So market participants enter the year with expectations of a large number of interest rate cuts through the course of 2024. And here we are towards the end of Q1. And we all now expect there to be fewer, if any, interest rate cuts. And yes, that's had no apparent impact on equity markets or on that narrow band of equities other than to drive them a bit higher. And the point you're making, isn't it, is that although the market might have been disappointed by the fact that there are going to be fewer interest rate cuts in 2024, on the compensating side, the economic data has been so much more positive. So what's been taken away with one hand has been given back by another. Is that a fair simplification?
Yes, no. I suppose it's two different markets, isn't it? It's the fixed income market and the equity market. So in a way, yes, the fixed income market has repriced half the way. And maybe some people still expect more cuts than they're likely to happen. But the market's sort of your average pricing. I think the equity markets have taken that in their stride, as you suggest. So they've taken the good news on potential growth more positively. But even having said that, actually, in a way, it's more that they've been increasing multiples, in a sense, is that actually it's the risk premiums are compressing. So it's not so much that we're expecting a lot better earnings, but actually, if interest rates are a bit higher, then the price you're playing for risk in equities has gone up a little bit. So there's been a bit of more risk appetite. So I think it's, yes, there's some good fundamental data, but actually people are willing to take a bit more risk at the moment. Now, having said that, the market still remains in equities a little bit narrow in some respects. So those big seven, magnificent seven that we talked about, it's starting to winnow down to Nvidia and maybe Meta are the sort of winners. So we've seen actually Tesla down, you know, I think it's more than 30% for the year to date. At the time we were recording this, so down a considerable way. The market as a whole, without those big names, in terms of earnings and in terms of sort of price levels, is down for the year once you subtract some of the large names. So I think, yes, things look buoyant. People are taking a lot of risk and feeling a bit more happy about the situation. But there is somewhat still a vulnerability. So it isn't a sort of consistent view on better growth overall. I think there is definitely the risk appetite nature of it is more significant.
Yes, as you say, Magnificent Seven is becoming Dynamic Duo, and who knows, might become Lone Ranger in due course. But anyway, moving away from inflation rates and equities to gold, which I suppose historically, or rather when you think about it, in a pure play economic or markets fashion, should correlate to real interest rates. That is to say, the lower the real interest rates, the lower the opportunity cost of holding a non-yielding asset. And yet, despite the fact that inflation is easing off in the US, and despite the fact that expectations for rate cuts are reduced, so therefore, you know, it looks as though real rates have slightly gone up a bit, or expectations from them, we've actually seen a rally in gold price in recent weeks. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how you understand this, what's driving this recently pretty good performance of gold?
Yeah, I think certainly, as with many asset classes, it isn't just one variable that drives the asset class the whole time. There are these different variables that can work, and they work at different moments or become more or less important. So gold, yes, one of the key driving forces is the real interest rate. Gold behaves a bit like an inflation-linked bond, given effectively the storing or storing cost or opportunity cost of holding gold, and the fact it's an asset which provides no cash flow. So there are moments where it behaves very closely to the real interest rate. Of late, the last month or so, there's been less of a correlation than there had been previously. So that's not been the driving force as significantly as maybe some of the other factors we'll touch on. And I think even to that, which when we were talking about interest rates, the point we missed or that I didn't touch on earlier was actually one of the key factors about that sort of interest rate outlook is the fact that the inflation data has been a bit more sticky. That last mile of going from 3% down to 2% has just not been evident. We've seen the stickier service sector inflation is the key fundamental reason why that view on interest rates is starting to reprice this year. And that a bit touches on gold. So what are the reasons why people are a bit more positive on gold? I think one of the reasons is viewing it as an inflation hedge. So that certainly is behind some of the recent appeal. And also as a safe haven in a world where there is heightened geopolitical and other risks that are hard to hedge. I think that certainly plays some of the reason. But when we look at who's been the buyer, it hasn't been that it's been driven by investor flow. When we look at ETF holdings, actually they've been going down rather than up. So the buyer, main buyer, has been central banks, particularly those outside the Western sphere of influence. So thinking about China, India, there's been a lot of buying in those regions. And that, I think, is where we see the bigger driver for gold and some of the other asset classes. But gold in particular has been thinking about weaker dollar. So actually, in this world where potentially, we've got some weakness set for the dollar when we look at the fundamental position, the large deficits there are in the US, the chance of rate cuts, even if it doesn't look like they're coming. Certainly, it's unlikely to see lots of rate hikes. So weaker potential monetary policy into the future has been fueling somewhat of a negative viewpoint. So there's the fundamental driver of what could be driving a negative dollar position, and also some of those geopolitical factors of why central banks, regions outside the Western sphere of influence, don't want to hold dollars as their foreign reserve holding. So there has certainly been this bid for gold linked also to technicals. So for an asset class where there aren't the positive cash flows, a lot is driven by technicals and sort of investor appetite. And so in a world where on the face of it, gold is touching to, in nominal terms, at least record highs and getting ready to break out. That's sort of been behind this trading range we've seen of late. It's what's going to force it through that range. And that's been behind a bit of the appetite that we've seen lately and could continue to see in the future. So I think those are some of the reasons. But I think more fundamentally is thinking about weaker dollar and the opportunity to hold a real asset or something that can at least try and preserve in the long run its purchasing power in a world where, although QE looks like it's behind us for the moment, actually, as when we look at that sticky inflation, the likelihood of monetary policy being behind inflation for a sustained period of time, that chance of financial repression still looks like the default policy setting in a world with the amount of debt we have. So I think that's one of the other main reasons why people are looking at gold. And it's not just been gold when we see the bids for Bitcoin or other assets. There's been quite a wide viewpoint.
Maybe we should talk a bit about that, Robert, because I know on the podcast that Meryn Somerset Webb hosts, where she invites market participants to join her, she always ends by asking them whether they would own gold or Bitcoin. And then recently, I think she featured somebody who was talking about, I think it was the Bold portfolio, which is a mix of Bitcoin and gold. What do you make of that, Robert? Is there an argument for owning a bit of both, the tried and tested gold, but with all the drawbacks we know about the gap between the physical and a security storage costs, and the new, which is Bitcoin, which is doesn't have storage costs, very easily transferable? Is the answer to own both?
I think I'll say my viewpoint, and I'll also say I think this is one of these areas when you don't have an asset which is a productive real asset linked to growth in the economy. It's not about a positive view on mankind and innovation. I think that should be the core of your portfolios. It's more down to personal preference. And I think there are portfolio reasons for diversification and for hedging some of these extreme risks where you do want assets like gold or Bitcoin. But it's not necessarily for everyone. I think that's important. So it's not a you have to have, but I think there are benefits to it. And when we look at the two, what are the benefits? On one side, gold is something which has lasted for millennia and will last for as far as we can see in the universe. And yes, there's a lot more gold in the universe than we see at the moment. So in the future, there will be more supply of gold, but that's quite a long way out. So yes, there's something tangible. It's lasted for a long time. So if you're thinking about the Nassim Taleb, the Lindy effect, this is an asset that you think is going to last and persist. So that I think there is a rationale. We've talked about some of the economic reasons why you want a piece of gold in your portfolio, and it can certainly at the moment hedge better than maybe financial assets for that extreme risk. On Bitcoin, as we alluded to, there is a finite supply, and the technology is sound up to the point of whether you can crack a really hard mathematical problem of P equals NP. It's not without its risk, but the risks are extremely small. And it's weathered the storms very well up to this point. And it will do while there's enough usage and while the price is high enough to encourage miners and to keep the supply so that it's a distributed network and it's not controlled by one party. So that's great news. So it's proved itself. As you say, it's very portable. In countries where it's very hard to get your money out and there's been high inflation, think Argentina or Turkey, there's a lot of reason why local investors would want to use it as a store of value. And there is the up case if it does become more widely used, and we've seen the approval of ETFs making it easier for people to transact, there is actually a positive case in terms of numbers of users going up. So you can make a case for having some Bitcoin. I think with the caveat at the moment that it's quite thinly traded. So a lot of people are holding. So even though these prices are going up, it's not from as many long-term transactions as apparent at the moment. So I think sized appropriately, some Bitcoin and some gold, if you want a piece of your portfolio to protect against those extreme risks and to be used in a time of crisis, I think can make a lot of sense. But equally, in the across the wider probability of outcomes, having more productive assets linked to the real economy is certainly the main answer for investors. So I think that's where you have to reiterate. It's interesting to talk about, but it's not going to what's going to drive the long term real returns for clients.
You touched on both. Just quickly going back to gold, so tried and tested, but the price has gone up recently. Have we missed it? So I guess my question is, are we thinking of adding further gold to portfolios, which we have had, by the way, for a long time, or are there other ways in which we can get exposure to gold?
So I think the short answer would be to say, I think we've got the right size. It's bigger than other investors, I think, at the moment. But yes, gold's gone up. But in real terms, it's not at the record highs. And there are a lot of those reasons why you want it within your portfolio. So I think keep the gold within your portfolio. What we're actually looking to do is to try and increase the return a little bit and take advantage for a market where there's been certainly investors have shunned is gold miners. So gold miners relative to gold is certainly at an extreme at the moment. There's been a lack of investment. And again, it's good news to go into an area where in lack of investment, it's got a long sort of capital cycle, which is the case with gold mining. So the price of gold being where it is, actually, there's a lot of positive free cash flow into the future to support that idea. So that's what we are looking to do to client portfolios in a way to sort of augment the return, but not to reduce materially our exposure to gold at the moment.
Thank you. We've left Europe out. Let's, for those sitting in Europe, let's include Europe in the conversation. And we touched on it our recent asset allocation committee. And I guess what's the question? I think the question, Robert, is what's going on in the European economy, do you think, at the moment, as a sort of backdrop? We'll come on to talk a bit about markets, but what do we think's going on in the European economy?
So I think the key bit that we wanted to stress really is about the manufacturing cycle. So this comes back to how COVID has distorted a lot of the data. And we've seen this big difference between services and goods when everyone stayed at home and all you could buy was goods, come back to services. The last few years, we've seen this downturn in manufacturing, which was affected at various points by those supply chain issues, which exasperated the conditions. Now, a lot of those issues have worked their way through. We've had this disinflationary period, and we've seen inventory destocking. Now, inventories are relatively low. There's the possibility for inventory restocking and some tighter supply chain points, and notably if we're thinking about some of the pressures in shipping of late. So we've started to see the signs of maybe the manufacturing cycle bottoming, which I think is good news for global economy in the short term. Good news for Europe, given exposure to manufacturing. Now, Germany in particular is one of the sick poster childs for the sort of sick Europe at the moment in terms of growth. So, yes, that's a positive sort of impulse, and it could be assisted to a small degree by some pickup in China. But I think so. That's the good news that maybe is overlooked. Everybody's pretty bearish on Europe, but there's the potential for a bit of short-term pickup in growth. The problem is actually sentiment remains really poor. And I think that's where sort of short-term, longer-term factors, that Europe still has a lot of longer-term issues and problems. And Germany in particular, if we just look at the energy situation and manufacturing, if we take those 2 points, after the issues with Russia and gas, Germany in particular remains vulnerable in its energy supply and certainly has higher cost energy into the future. And we've seen this change in China in terms of the amount of growth that spills over to the rest of the world. And lastly, China, in a way, wants to maintain its position as the manufacturing powerhouse. And that's bad news for Germany in the long run. And we've seen that one example be electric vehicles. The way in the last 3 years, really, China has completely overtaken Germany in terms of being the electric vehicle powerhouse, manufacturing powerhouse for the world. And they want to do that on a broader range of parts of the economy. So I think Europe has a lot of issues, Germany in particular. Southern Europe has looked a relatively more positive spot. Let's take Iberia, albeit some of those aspects of the economy, particular tourism, are not necessarily going to support the economy as strongly maybe in the coming years it's done in previous years. So I think to that point about wither Europe, I think there are long-term issues that remain the problem, and the economies overall are in a relatively weak position. So I think are vulnerable to a slowdown in the US would be the key part. So I think that still remains, I think, the key variable for this year is if the US starts to slow, that will be bad news for Europe, given where it starts from. And the longer term structural issues about being stuck between US and China, both of which want to be more domestically resilient and rely more on in terms of onshoring. Again, not great news to be caught in Europe in between those two warring parties and also sources of innovation. So I think the European economy, not necessarily the stock markets, do face some of those big issues in the future.
So big picture, Europe remains challenged and vulnerable economically, as arguably it is, as we're all talking about sort of militarily. We've allowed ourselves or have become, you know, quite dependent on those around us and less autonomous. But within Europe, I think the point you're making, and perhaps that's manifest in the change in the bond spread between Italian and German bonds, where they've narrowed, i.e. people are more optimistic about Italy, more pessimistic about Germany. Within Europe, okay, big picture challenge, but within Europe, some of the economies that historically one thought of as being weaker are doing slightly better. By contrast, Germany, which historically has always been this sort of resilient powerhouse, is actually looking a bit weaker.
Yeah, in many ways, weaker Germany could have some positive spillovers to the rest of the world, to the rest of Europe. Having said that, I think you do want for strong Europe and strong growth, you do need a strong Germany. So that still is going to be a problem going forward. So I think the issues of Europe benefit from general risk appetite improving. So I think those spreads we've talked about between Italy and Germany, part of it is just general positive sentiment in markets, spreads converge. Part of it is a slightly better economic data and also relatively worse data in Germany. But those fundamental issues at the heart of Europe have not gone away. And we also have the threat of sort of extremist parties and the issues of how you deal with migration emerging still within France. We just have to look forward to the next presidential election. And even within Germany, when we look at the pressures of within their, or sort of felt by the farming sector of the economy. And more broadly, I think German banking remains one of the vulnerable points actually to pressures within loans and investments made in the US, but also local and domestic loans as well. So I think there's vulnerable points still within the European banking system that haven't been completely removed.
Robert, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks and look forward to hopefully you joining then. Thank you. Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Talking Capital on all major platforms. Capital Generation Partners, LLP, is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority and is registered as an investment advisor by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. This podcast and opinions expressed do not constitute investment advice and do not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase any security or any other investment or product. Nothing said during this podcast should be construed as an invitation or inducement to engage in investment activity. All information and opinions expressed herein are current as of publication and are subject to change without notice. The information contained in this podcast does not constitute research or recommendation from Capital Generation Partners to the listener. Capital Generation Partners makes no representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or of any of the information contained in this podcast. And any liability, therefore, including in respect to direct or indirect loss, is expressly disclaimed. Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. This podcast may not be copied, reproduced, further distributed to any other person, or published in whole or in part for any purpose. Further information, including our privacy statement, can be found on our website at www.capitalgenerationpartners.com.